So our next speaker is John Wood. John did his academic career at King's University, neighbor to us in British Columbia. And I worked with him on a lot of things, and he was also connected with ASA very intimately recently, heading it up, and also the Asobel Institute. But now he's going to talk about death, the necessity of death in creation care, theology, and practice. So now get ready for our second death talk here.
Thank you, Lowell. It was a sharp and refreshing talk that I were hearing about. So several things as we begin here. First of all, just some shameless self-promotion. As you go by the CSCA desk, you'll see some wonderful brochures there. If you happen to have seen some of those, there's this little orange one, and it's really deadly, and you should look at it. But seriously, this is about ecology and the necessity of death. Some of this I'll touch on today. Much of it I won't, because the focus of this talk really is aimed at creation care and conservation biology perspective. And this follows up on work that I have done, a publication on the ecological phenomenon of death from cells to the biosphere, shaping the entire creation. And we'll talk a little bit about that as well. The way this talk came around and was two things. One, in the abstract, you saw a little story about my daughter. A number of years ago, we saw an elephant die on the TV. That was a powerful experience in her life and in mine. And I'm an ecologist and in training, population ecologist, in fact. And that really just sat with me, because it hits at the emotional level. It hits you in your heart. It hits you in your family. And I've grown up as a hunter, and I know what killing an animal is. And to see that, though, in a poaching experience, you see, I wanted to say to her, but at 5 years old, you don't say this. I would say, honey, you just saw evil expressed there in that death. But when we sat down to have chicken and fish and beef and other animals, and when we sat down to have corn and peas and carrots and potatoes, that's a different kind of death. And that's a very hopeful death, because it's going to grow you and make you strong. And so we experience death every day. The scripture is really plain about that. It's plain about death. And Lowell, to your point about discipleship, I think you're absolutely right. As I think about Jesus speaking to his disciples, he not only talked about hope, and he not only talked about behavior, but he talked continuously about what? About dying, about intentionally going to Jerusalem. And Peter said to him, "No, Lord, not that, not you." And Jesus says, "Oh, you're right." Oh, he turned and said, "Get behind me, Satan. For this I will do." Every day, we need to begin to talk, hopefully and intentionally, about the kinds of things that Jesus said, that the entire scriptures from beginning to end say, about physical mortality. For it is death that is the gateway. You see death in the chase here, and you see death in the chomping here in front of you. The other place that this came from was talking to my colleagues in ASA, one of which was Keith Miller, who proposed that we do some articles on death a few years ago, scholarly stuff. And then more recently, Randy Isaac, who's in the audience here, and Stephen Freeland, I've seen Jim Stump has been here this week, did a series of articles on life, abiogenesis, the forming of life. And toward the end of that, I asked some questions about, with Randy, we had a conversation. So what does the theory of death have to do with the theory of life? Well, you really have to clear back death in order to have life maintained. So there's a very fruitful conversation to have there. And this is really getting at this, this theorizing of death. We have Darwin and natural selection in our vocabulary. But what else is going on? What is death? How does it actually operate? And I would suggest that we have not thought deeply enough, and the point of this talk is not to give the answers, but to open the question, because it's very hard to open the question. We need to transform the binary of life is good and death is bad. Can we imagine a positive role for death? And now you hear you say, a biologist? Oh, of course, you biologists, you talk about death because that's your professional engagement. Theologically, we, oh, wait a minute. Well, wait a minute. Paul Santmeier, Lutheran theologian and author of fundamental ecological texts, Travail of Nature, but most recently has asked this question: how is it that a gospel that is based on a crucified Savior cannot speak about the death that's happening in our culture, in us, in the creatures, in the entire creation, in the possible? What we say is Jesus' death and resurrection, and we race past the death, unless we want to talk about the horror of it, we race past the death to talk about the resurrection and spend our time on the harrowing of hell and the raising of the saints. And we get tossed into dispensationalism and all kinds of other ways of thinking about, wait, what about the death? Let's turn and think about mortality, because I think Jesus thought deeply about that. Well, I gave in this paper in 2016, The Particular Phenomenology of Ecology, what I have learned about death as a population ecologist. And death is with us from cells all the way through. Here's the sculpting of what's called PCD, or programmed cell death. The sculpting, the digits that you have. Why don't we have webbed? Well, it's because developmentally you had this that became this. And this is gone because it's a developmental mechanism. And that's sculpting. And it goes through, as you see on the right-hand side, you can sculpt beauty with death. Look at this aquatic plant up close. You see the beauty of that lace plant. Just gorgeous stuff. The very structure of the creation, the form of the leaves on the trees, the plants themselves, the bark, the grass, every organism is shaped by programmed cell death, a genetically conserved trait. And it's actually a suite of mechanisms that we won't talk about today, but it's there and present. So I'll just give you a quick example out of my own research. California has been in the news, everywhere has been in the news about drought and washout. We're either at one end of the spectrum or the other, and that's what climate change does. It pushes us to those extremes. That was my research in the 1980s, and you see on the left a drought situation. We call that not death for organisms in a drought, we call it ecological stress. And then you see ecological disturbance when you get a washout. So David gave us a knotweed example, and those plants were disturbed. As we don't talk about death so much. And it has a positive response. Here's an organism that is adapted. They're tiny during drought, and they become huge. Same species, adapted. I think there are some examples we can look at the creatures that respond to these extreme conditions, and we might learn some adaptive lessons just by closely observing. As Jesus said, consider the lilies of the field. Walk by the way, look at these things. Look at these creatures and see what they do. So you see a drought in California, the red there are 200-year-long droughts, and some modeling suggests that we could well in the United States, in the Southwest, the Colorado Basin, and the rest, be into a very long period, because historically we've been there. So we need to be thinking about these lessons, and we've been taught about it by ecologists, biologists, and others working for years about food webs and how they work. Well, how does a food web work? Well, it's consumption. Well, that means the death of all kinds of organisms in the chase and in the herbivory. Robert Payne, working up in Pacific Northwest, worked with keystone species. Predators actually shape the ecosystem. They shape the organisms that are present there. And when we get alien species coming in, they reshape the place in one way or another. And they do that by a mechanism of death. And Payne demonstrated that in his field work, that certain species are key, and those species are almost always what? Consumptive in one way or another. Or they kill by crowding out other species, if they're plants, by overwhelming, taking over the space, consuming the necessities of life for these other ones. So we see death is all the way, and then you go to the planetary level out in the oceans here, and you see there on the lower left, you see this plankton bloom, well, these small single-celled organisms. And we discovered in oceanography in the 1930s and 40s that these blooms would be there, and 2 days later, they were gone. And it took another 20, 30 years to recognize that what's happening there is programmed cell death. It's a genetically programmed cell, triggered in a way that we don't understand, but affects these blooms. And so when we're looking to look at sargasso weed and phytoplankton blooms and enrichment of nitrogen and all of how, we need to understand this death mechanism. But my sense is nobody wants to talk about it because death is evil. Death is wrong. You see any death there? Is that evil? You know what that is? There's a hint. I grew up on a farm, so. Well, it turns out this is actually a natural good. There's all kinds of death there. That's the only way that cow patty can be recycled is by things to die. And the only reason the cow patty's there is because plants died. And as I say to my students, that was not Charles Darwin's idea. This is the way God created the earth, in this kind of system of eat and be eaten. And then I got to thinking, and I talked with Dave Warners about soil formation, and I realized there's an entire kingdom, 100,000 species or more of mushrooms, fungi, molds, smuts, and all kinds of interesting things, and they're all based on what? Death and dying. Dead stuff. An entire kingdom of organisms. And you think, where did that come from? How did that arise? This is part of God's good creation. It's a positive value that we have medicinal things. We have some things we directly utilize and we eat, and of course it can be delicious, or they can kill you. But death awareness really can terrorize us. And I'm desperately looking for the clock, David, to see where I am. It's over there. Thank you. And death salience, the social psychologists have told us, functions positively in our life. This is a poster at my swimming pool. And you just don't want your kid too far away in the water. Right? Because bad things can happen there. Well, our culture is aware existentially of death. We are aware that we are literally scared to death. And it came up, but the way we do it is we ridicule it, right? Halloween, the terror movies, the vampire movies. We love to go to the theater and be scared to death because it's what? It's safe. Or we ridicule death. And recently, I was just blown away when the Barbie, this was on a trailer for this movie. And here we have pink plastic, stylized life, and in the transition, one of the markers of this doll becoming human and being able to engage the real world is what? They're dancing away, and all of a sudden she stops and says, "Hey, you guys, you ever think about dying?" The music stops, they all go, right? Well, we all do. Mortality, finitude, endings are serious. And you don't have to teach this to people. Although you do have to teach your kids not to run on the road. And sometimes you have to, but if you don't learn the lesson orally, you're going to learn it practically. Because death is, ecologists started paying attention to death in terms of predators, and there's direct effects of mortality. So yes, the hawk does eat the squirrel. But what was fascinating is the indirect effects. You can simply scare an organism into not only changing its behavior, but its actual output and production of offspring. Because a female who's scared doesn't have enough time to feed to have as many babies. That feeds into the life table, into the population structure. And I was talking with someone about elephants and an overabundance of elephants. We need to think carefully about death. And the reason I'm hammering on this is because we've stopped thinking about it. If you go to an ecology textbook, look up death. I've scanned them. 20, 30, 40 different textbooks. You will not find death. You'll find all the synonyms for death. You won't find death or mortality. And by the way, the inverse is true in theology. You are hard-pressed to find, except for the care and pastoral care of dead and dying people. You go to the theology text, you will find some things, but in fact, when you actually look up the detail, it's a little bit, half a page, a paragraph, and it's difficult. Now, recently that has been changing. And the creation care community has had an impact on that. But this is old. Linnaeus saw it. He recognized that if death does not operate as a good in the creation, we would be overwhelmed if every seed became a plant, if every fly egg became a fly, if every organism grew up without it. This applies also as you turn around and look backwards, this theodicy question of extinctions. And the extinction of species over time. So it's how does the world work? Death has been the mechanism, and it's God's mechanism for shaping, sculpting not only individual organisms, individual species, communities, entire ecosystems, replacing ecosystems with others. It's like a biophony through time. And scientists, paleontologists, all kinds of get pretty excited because we study that in depth and we see how that works, and it's just, wow, you're in awe and wonder of that. Well, I want to apply physical death now to a few principles, and I'm at this front end of just starting to think about this. One of those, and the first principle of creation care that I think comes out, is biotic death was present from the very beginning. That is, consider Genesis 1. Fruitfulness is right there with its twin, death. Be fruitful and multiply fishes. Be fruitful and multiply birds. Be fruitful and... How does a fish, a shark, how does a tuna, how... Start naming any organism. Be fruitful and multiply. Being fruitful and multiply means you're going to consume lots of other things. Well, we don't read birth and death there when we read that story, but it's present there, sort of hidden from us, but it's present. Secondly, clearly in Deuteronomy, and Moses makes this so clear, that the land is a gift. And as I look into this picture, I see death and I see doxa. I see the glory of God in that picture. Not just in the beauty of those fields, but there's death all over in that picture. There's deep time geologic formation of that river and stream and those strata there that our geologists know so well. There's soil formation that only can happen from the presence of death. So the land as gift is only a gift as things have physical mortality and die. And then, of course, flourishing absolutely depends on endings. The metaphor that Jesus uses is a pruning metaphor, and a vine and pruning, and we apply that to our lives, and that's a very important thing, but that's drawn from an actual, that's how the world works. Fruitfulness, Lowell, if those roots are, if that's a root bound or plant in a pot, what does the horticulturalist do? The loving caretaker takes it out, tears it up, and puts it in a different container. That's a pruning metaphor. This is, it's as old as scripture. Or maybe it happens this way. This is a different way to prune. You prune a population of animals. The groaning of creation has really bothered us. And I'm not convinced that our theodicies help us, because we frame it as God has a problem, we have to explain sin and we have to explain suffering and death. God does not need us to explain suffering and death for him. Okay. He created the world to work this way. He is creator. And he says at multiple places that he owns it all. None of it is outside of his purview. None. So physical death, the death is one thing. The death that does concern us is the dislocation of relationship. The breakdown in the garden is not that Eve died the moment the apple touched her lips. And our theologians are reinterpreting that and saying to us, oh no, there's other things. She kept living physically. What died? Brokenness. Brokenness with Adam, brokenness with God, brokenness with the creatures, and deep rupture. And are we broken in our relationship? Do we need to grieve? Do we need to groan? And the groaning there, by the way, is part of this last one, and that is doxa, invoking a reflection of longing, of grief over what we see, but also awe and wonder. And Christopher Southgate, theologian in England who has written the text on the theodicy of the suffering of and death of animals, has recently come out with a book on doxa, the glory of God reflected in all of this that I've been talking about. And he says God owns that. So this is not just an ecologist suggesting this. I'm saying theologians are suggesting it, and they have been. He says it's not only the doxa of the doxa mundi, the glorious mundi of the earth, it's glory of the cross. It's glory of the mortal death. The door that Jesus goes through is the door every creature goes through, and that's finitude. That idea in the 20th century comes from Barth, Brunner, Bonhoeffer, and other theologians coming forward, Pannenberg at the end of the 20th century, and a host of other theologians that I won't list off for you, who started talking about finitude, endings. Creatures have always been mortal. The challenge for the church is, when I say this to people, it is the traditional view that has reigned in the church for the last three or four centuries, actually goes back to Augustine, and that is that physical death came in the garden through Adam and Eve. That's what I grew up with. And when I first confronted this set of ideas, I went to the theologians to try and understand, could hardly read them, hardly understand what they were talking about. And then when it finally dawned on me, I realized, that's it. It's not that death originated with Adam and Eve. Relational death, yes, that brokenness of in the creation that will be restored, that will be renewed, and that we are charged with now, and this is the gloria in the eschatology, in the eschaton, the glory and the hope in the future is it will be renewed. And we are now renewing, that's the creation care charge, and, but what? now, but not yet. We see what? We see it darkly. Paul talks about this extensively. So this is what Southgate talks about as three-lens seeing. How many minutes? Thank you. He calls it three-lens seeing. Gloria mundi, the gift of land and creature praise. Their deaths praise God. Gloria crucis, the gift of the incarnation of Christ and the sacrifice that he makes, that self-sacrifice, and that he does what? Oh, by the way, that's an option for you in discipleship. If you'd like self-sacrifice, you can do it, but it's a secondary thing. Mostly have fun. My students get this after a while, right? Sometimes it takes a while. Gloria excelsis, the eschatological new song of the creation, and we hear echoes of it, and we have moments of it, and it stirs us. It heals us, it's encouraging us, and it's intended to. This is old, as I said. Dietrich Bonhoeffer's, if you haven't seen his sermons in 1933 on the creation, it's a marvelous read theologically. Joseph Sittler, the nature theologian, Lutheran, in 1950 already, and in 1970, actually uses creation care as a phrase and word. I think he really is the kind of 20th century talking about our ecological commitment as a theological responsibility, responsibility. And there are many others. Well, my friend here, Francis Schaeffer, I say friend because I actually asked him a question one time and 3 months later, I got the answer back in a letter, very nicely. But what did he say about biophilia, the love of life? What did he say about, and Lowell referred to this, what did he say about pollution and the death of man ecology? Well, he was very clear about that, but he was also clear with C. Everett Koop about what? Human life and human death, both ends of that spectrum. But we narrowed it in. And because of our traditional view, we wrote the creation out of that conversation. We kept it focused on medicalized human death and processes. And we've gotten ourselves to where? We've gotten ourselves into a bind on how to deal with births and how to deal with deaths. And that's for humans, but what about for the rest of the creation? And what Schaeffer was pointing to was that the creation is our witness. The creation speaks of what God is doing, and our interaction with that creation speaks about who we are. We are God's disciples. We love his creation. We care for it. We're concerned for it. That's his message here. We biophilia. We love it. And it interferes with our witness to those that we so much want to witness to because we think apologetics is about the mind. It's about your heart, your life, and your love. Okay. Theologians are talking about this in a popular way. I was referring to academic theologians mostly, but if you come forward, you'll see John Walton in Lost World of Genesis 1. He just begins to make this so clear. They are reinterpreting. Theologians are reinterpreting without reference to the natural sciences. They're not worried about scientific theories. They're working about biblical understanding and good exegesis of the text. And they're understanding, no, the reason we were not subject to death was because the antidote to our mortality was there, had been provided in that tree of life that was sitting there all along. The thing that we would transfer. And more recently, let's see these two, is this is a father-son from Wheaton, Father Moo and Douglas Moo and Jonathan Moo. And the curse, it's not representing some sort of mysterious ontological change in the very makeup of creation. Nothing happened to the structure that you're looking at, okay? It happened to the relationship between us and those creatures. And that's a very different way. Okay, here's where we're going. Here's an artist's conception. The metaphor of shalom and flourishing. The way to flourishing is through mortal death, through physicality. It's by eating your peas and your apples, your carrots. It's through growing up well. Physical death is a tool for reweaving. And if you want to do conservation biology, you sometimes have to use power. But you have to use it with wisdom for the flourishing of all of the creation, not just for humans. Oh, as one city councilman said, when they were complaining about the deer that were eating in the flower beds, and he says, you know, we don't have a deer problem. We got a human problem. We built all these structures that are attractive to deer, and they came in, and then we go, what are these deer doing here? You can build other structures that'll keep them elsewhere. It's a long story about that. Finally, with this, I close. I think we've overlooked a key piece of what Moses had to say, what God had to say through us in Moses. In Deuteronomy 30, he gives us an offering, and he says, here is Mount Ebal. Here is Mount Gerizim. Here is life, and here is death. And he calls on Israel, this day I call and choose life. He pleads with them. Choose life, not death. But then what do you notice? Who are the witnesses? Who are the signers of the document of marriage that we're going to choose life? It's the creatures. I call on heaven and earth. I don't call on the Egyptians that you fled from. I don't call on the Canaanites, the Philistines, the Amorites. I don't call on humanity to witness against you. In the judgment, and there's not a text for this. This is just what I'm imagining by what I see here. Is that the whole creation will be present with us in that process, witnessing to what we have done. May you be good, God's good earth keepers in life and in death. Thank you.
Thank you very much.